Welcome back, everybody. Today we will address a very important topic, important on fundamental grounds and important also practically for cosmology. On fundamental grounds, it's important because it concerns the vacuum. The question we will address today is, what is the vacuum state? Of all the states in the Hilbert space, which one should be called the vacuum state in the case of an expanding curved space-time? Then let us keep in mind that to identify which state is the vacuum state goes to the heart of what is existence, because we built on the vacuum state, on the notion of the vacuum state, we built a Fock space, right, on the vacuum state, and that means the multiparticle states. We define what we mean by a particle by first defining what the vacuum state is. So it appears to be a fundamental issue, which is the no particle state? And we will, to be careful, define the vacuum state as being the no particle state. We will not jump to the conclusion that it's the lowest energy state. We will check whether it is or not. But initially, let's just think of the vacuum state as being the empty state, meaning empty of particles. And that defines then what we mean by a particle. And what we will find is a little bit unsatisfactory. On one hand, we will find a notion of vacuum state, but it's not elegant. It's sort of an engineering fix. And there could be two reasons for this. One reason is that it's just too early. Somebody will figure it out. And there will be an elegant, convincing, illuminating definition of what the vacuum state is. One day, maybe one of you will figure it out. That's one possibility. But the other possibility is that fundamentally there is no such thing as a vacuum state. This engineering fix that we will use today, which is the standard fix used in the standard model of cosmology, works, but it only works for the space-times that we are considering. Space-times that are wildly varying, that are in the nonlinear regime, that might be contracting and expanding at the same time at different places, they simply may not have a vacuum state. There may not be such a thing as a vacuum state. In fact, as we will see today, we should not expect that there is a vacuum state, that there exists a state which qualifies to be called the vacuum state at all time. The best we can possibly hope for is to have a definition of what the vacuum state is at any point in time. So it could be that it is not possible to define a vacuum state elegantly, convincingly, generally, for whatever space-time. But philosophically, this means that the very notion, not only of vacuum, but also of definite particle states, is an illusion. It's just a good approximation. And we happen to live in a universe in which the notion of particle makes a lot of sense. You see, this goes beyond quantum uncertainty. Of course, we can easily write down states in quantum field theory in which the particle number is uncertain. And that's not such a big deal. For photons, for example, we usually don't have particle number eigenstates. There's usually some quantum uncertainty in which how many photons we actually have. No, what I'm talking about today goes beyond that, in the sense that the very notion of what we mean by a particle could be ambiguous. There may not be a number operator that's unique. So unfortunately, the issue of the vacuum is going to be a little bit technical and an engineering fix. There is no elegant way to do this. Let's see, with this in mind, how the vacuum state is considered nowadays in cosmology. So remember, the overall task that we have at the moment is to identify which state in the Hilbert space we should call at a particular point in time the vacuum state. Which state in the Hilbert space describes the state without particles for a given point in time? Mathematically, the issue at hand is the following. Remember that we can solve our quantum field theory in many different ways. We can choose any set of mode functions as long as it obeys the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition, and plug it into our ansatz, and we get a solution for our quantum field. We get the solution for our quantum field. If we choose another mode function that obeys the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition, we can also write down the quantum field as a function of space and time, or in this case, as a function of co-moving momentum and conformal time. So these two are two examples of writing down the quantum field. They work with different mode functions, without a tilde, with a tilde, and with different A and A dagger operators, without and with a tilde. And there are infinitely many choices. We discussed last time how many choices there are per co-moving mode. And if you remember, we found that there's a two-dimensional space of candidates for mode functions, a two complex dimensional space of candidate mode functions that obey the Klein-Gordon equation, but only a three-dimensional subset of those also obeys the Wronskian condition. But that's still infinitely many, parameterized by three parameters. So then technically, the problem will be, if we pick a time, we want to know which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum state. And it will be convenient, once we figure out how to identify which is the vacuum state, it will be convenient to try to find a mode function such that its annihilation operator actually annihilates that vector. So that then, by applying a dagger multiple times on that, we can create multiple particle particle number eigenstates, Fock states, and therefore we have not just a vacuum state, but also we have a notion of how many particles there might be. In other words, to identify the vector in the Hilbert space, which describes at a given point in time the vacuum, is equivalent mathematically to choosing mode function. Because when you've chosen the mode function, that is to say, when you've chosen a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation in the Wronskian condition, then a certain set of A and A daggers is implied, and the vector that's annihilated by the A will be our vacuum state. So to choose a mode function or to choose a vacuum state is mathematically the same thing. Now, there are many different candidates, as we said, because there's a three-dimensional set of possible mode functions, solutions of the Klein-Gordon equations, which are also solutions to the Wronskian condition. Let us look at the relationship between them. And that will come up because the vector in the Hilbert space that describes the vacuum at one point in time may not be the same vector as the one that describes the vacuum at a later point in time. Therefore, in order to describe the first vacuum conveniently, we will choose one mode function. In order to describe the second vacuum, the vacuum state at a second time, conveniently, we will choose a second mode function. And each comes with its A and A dagger operators, or A tilde and A tilde dagger operators. So before we get into the nitty-gritty about how to identify which is the correct mode function, let us look at what the relationship is going to be between the mode functions and the A and A dagger operators with and without tilde if the one is describing the vacuum state at one time and the other one is describing the vacuum state at another time. So the first thing we notice is, and we discussed that briefly last time already, first thing we notice is that since for each k, the space of possible mode functions is has two complex dimensions, well, the space of solution to the Klein-Gödel equation has two complex dimensions, we have that any solution V tilde is going to be a linear combination, a complex linear combination of the solutions V and V star. Remember, V cannot be real in, if it is to obey the Wronskian condition. So we have V and V star are independent, and so they span our solution space. So if we make two choices, the two choices will be related in this way. The mode functions must be linear combinations of each other. And then if we put these two things together, namely that both are valid descriptions of our quantum field, together with this linear relationship between the untilded and the tilded mode function, we find that the alpha and the beta coefficients cannot be arbitrary. And that's because if V is a mode function, so it obeys the Klein-Gödel equation and the Wronskian condition, and V tilde obeys the Klein-Gödel equation and the Wronskian condition, then these alphas and betas cannot be arbitrary because the Wronskian condition is not a linear one. So these alpha and beta coefficients obey that relationship here. The A and the untilded and the tilded quantities are related in this way using the alphas and the betas. Yeah, so the conditions on the alpha and the betas we had here, sorry, in black. Alpha k squared minus beta k squared is equal to 1. That's the condition that they have to obey in order for the Wronskian condition of one solution to translate into the Wronskian condition of the other solution. And then once we have that, then we can work out from those two equations that the A and the A tildes are related in this way. And then the next question we asked and already answered in the previous lecture was how now are these Fock spaces related to each other? How are the vacua and how are the n-particle states related to each other? We start with the defining equation AK acting on the zero state is zero, and that becomes this equation because the annihilation operator without the tilde is this expression here. Now here we have tilded operators acting on an untilded state, so we don't easily know how it acts. The way to deal with this is to write this vector zero as an as yet unknown linear combination of all possible Fock states, and then this becomes an explicit Fock states in the tilded Fock space, then this becomes an explicit equation which can be solved, and that is the solution. So the vector zero of the first Fock space is a complicated infinite linear combination of vectors in the tilded Fock space. And here we should think of this as just a normalization. These are tensor factors, and that is really what matters here if we look at one mode, because this is just a product, tensor product of all modes. Here we have a power series, and we have A tilde daggers and A tildes, A tilde daggers and A tilde dagger, I mean with a K and with a minus K, and arbitrarily powers of those arise in here. As we discussed, what this means is that this state is a multiparticle state in the tilded Fock space where we always have particles in pairs. For every particle with momentum k, we also have a particle with momentum minus k. And it never ends. This thing sums up more and more and more terms. What that means is that this state, which might be the vacuum state at one point in time, is not just a multiparticle state with respect to the tilted Fock space, where this might be the vacuum state at another time. No, it's not just multiparticles, it's infinitely many particles. Because we can get arbitrarily many of these, arbitrarily high powers occur in here. They're suppressed with the factorial, but still there are arbitrarily high numbers of particles in here. In any case, what we have now is that the vector 0 without the tilde is expressed in, as a linear combination of the vectors in the tilded Fock space. And now if we apply a dagger operators here, then we can use this to turn it into the application of a dagger tilde operators on the right-hand side. And that means that not only are we relating here the two zero vectors to each other, but also n particle states here. We can now easily write down what they are as a linear combination of the basis vectors in the tilded Fock space. So how many particles would be created in this way if the tilted and the untilted Hilbert spaces, if the tilted and the untilted Fock spaces are based on vacua at two different times? Then how much particle creation would there be? Would that describe if the state of the system was the vacuum the first time, and then some evolution happens, and the state now has a different interpretation according to the tilted Fock space? How many particles would there be created? As we said, the linear combination that we calculated there includes arbitrarily many particles. But that doesn't mean that infinitely many particles are to be expected when measured. So how do we calculate how many particles would be created? Now remember the number operator from harmonic oscillators. The number operator acting on a dagger to the power n, so acting on the nth excited state of the harmonic oscillator or in quantum field theory, the number operator acting on one of those mode oscillators, n times excited, gives us the same gives us the same excited state again, but with the eigenvalue n. So if you have not done this calculation before, you should do it at least once. Now, in quantum field theory, we have for every mode oscillator, its own number operators, n hat index k, just given in this way. And the interpretation in quantum field theory is straightforward. So let us assume that at some point in time eta, the state 0 is the vacuum. We still haven't discussed yet how we know that. We'll get to that in a moment. But let's just for now assume that this vector, the one annihilated by the AK, this one by this AK, that this vector is the vacuum state at the time eta. Then this state is, at the time eta, a state with n particles with momentum k. Oh, pressed the wrong button. Now, let's assume instead that at some time eta, the system is not necessarily in this state, but it's in some arbitrary state. Let's call it omega. Well, in that case, the expectation value of the number operator gives us the expected, the average value of the number of particles that we would find of momentum k if measured at that time. So it's just the usual expectation value. So for every oscillator, for every mode oscillator of the quantum field, we can calculate at any time what the expected number of particles is. Where, of course, the nk must have the interpretation of being the number operator. And remember, that's a very perishable quality of such an operator. Because for nk to be the number operator, we must have that the corresponding a and a dagger that it is made of are the creation and annihilation operators of particles. And for that to be true, we must have that the a operator annihilates what is the vacuum state. But which is the vacuum state might change over time. So now, let's do a calculation in this scenario that we discussed. Namely, let's assume that at some point in time, the vacuum state is the vector zero, and then at some other point in time, it's another state. How many particles will there have been created? So at another time, it's the tilted operators, whose tilted vector zero is the vacuum state. Let's say that happens at time eta 2. So at time eta or eta 1, we have the untilted A annihilating what is the vacuum state. And at a time eta 2, it's the tilted A, which is annihilating what is then the vacuum state. So let's assume that at the initial time eta 1, this vector 0 is the vacuum state. And let's give that thing a name. Let's say it's the state omega. So our system is in the state omega, which is that state. And because we're working in the Heisenberg picture, it will always be that state, this state. Then we want to know how many particles do we find of momentum k at the later time eta 2. So then we need to look at this operator at the later time eta 2 and calculate its expectation value for that state. It's a frozen, I mean, this state is frozen in time because it's the Heisenberg picture. This thing evolves in time. But it turns out to be just this. And then we already established the relationship between the A with the tilde and the A without a tilde. It's this linear relationship here, where the actual values of alpha and beta depend on what the spacetime did. We will later see how to calculate those coefficients. So depending if the spacetime, for example, was just Minkowski space, then the betas would be 0, and the alphas would be 1, such that the ak are the a tilde k's. Nothing happened. But if spacetime undergoes some tremendous expansion, then the beta coefficients can become important. So we want to calculate what the number expectation value is, how many particles are there of momentum k later on, given that the spacetime did something, it expanded or whatever, or shrunk, leading to some alpha and beta coefficients, then what is the expected number of particles created for a particular momentum? Well, for that, we have to evaluate this quantity. This is the state of the system, but that's the number operator that we need to calculate, and that's the number operator for the tilted variables. But we do know how to express the tilted A's in terms of the untilted ones. And so let's do that. Let's plug that into here. And then we have only untilded operators and vectors. So this A tilde dagger becomes the first bracket, and the A tilde is the second bracket. If we spell all of this out, we get 4 terms, of which 3 will disappear right away. For example, whenever we have an A acting on the right on this vector, that's annihilated. And whenever we have an A dagger acting on the left, that's annihilated. So the only term that survives all of this is this one, where we have a beta star tilde and a beta tilde. So that overall, what we find is that, and this is a very important result that comes up this way, not only for cosmology, but for example, also for black hole physics, the amount of particle creation that you get in a Bogoliubov transformation is always given by the modulus squared of the beta coefficients of a Bogoliubov transformation. Right? And that's because when we spell this out, then all the alpha alpha and alpha beta terms are of the kind that they annihilate either to the right or to the left. So what we see from this is that once we know how to calculate how the expansion of space-time creates non-trivial values of alpha and beta, we know we can focus on just the betas. And the modulus squared of the betas gives us the particle creation. So what then is the total particle number? Well, the total particle number, if we don't care what momentum the particles have, is obtained by taking the expectation value for each momentum, for each co-moving momentum, the expectation value of the number operator, and summing them all up, which is the series over all the moduli squared of all the beta coefficients. Remember that each mode, each k, for each three-component k vector, we have an independent harmonic oscillator, we have an independent Bogoliubov transformation. So we get all these coefficients and we have this series, which may or may not converge. So in principle, it could be that the number of particles created, the expectation value of the number of particles created, is actually infinite. Could happen. That is not in itself a contradiction to experiment, for example. What we do need, of course, otherwise the theory would be wrong, is that the expectation value of the energy that gravity has pumped into the quantum field has to be finite. So if we calculate the expectation value of the energy, well, that better be less than infinite. But that doesn't mean that this number operator has to be finite too. For example, and this comes up even in ordinary electrodynamics, even without gravity, here we are considering how many particles are being created by gravity. But the same issue comes up even earlier when you just consider electrodynamics. Let's say you have an electron and you shake it. Well, that does the job of creating photons. It's like its own little antenna. If you shake an electron, you will make electromagnetic waves. And of all sorts of momenta. And you can ask, well, okay, how many photons of which momentum am I creating here? And generically, you find it's infinitely many. Photons are really cheap. See, they energetically, they're very cheap. Because the amount of energy that is in a photon is proportional to its frequency. If the frequency is very small, it's very little energy in there. And you can easily have a number distribution of photons where the total expectation value of the number of photons is infinite, but the energy that they represent is finite. It is a headache, though, in actual calculations, because when you have infinitely many particles, then you have so-called infrared divergences can come up in this case.
But you also have to divide by the volume of the space, right? I mean, for an infinite volume of
space. Oh, yes. Very good point. Yeah, thank you. Sorry, I forgot about this. It is true that what we want is that the energy density is finite. The energy itself may be infinite, because if we are modeling a universe that is just infinite in extent, that spatially is R3, then any finite energy density translates into a total energy that's infinite. Now, here the point is that you can have an infinite number density, but you still have a finite energy density. That's right. You should consider the whole thing in a volume.
You have implicitly divided by the volume that's already the number density, right? Because there was a direct delta coming from...
Right. Well, yes, I mean, in general, we want to work here with putting everything in a box, in a box, because otherwise, remember what would happen. We would have that instead of the commutation relations having a Kronecker delta on the right-hand side, we would have a Dirac delta. And if you look at the A and A dagger operators, you know, they are supposed to raise and lower by one and not by an infinity. So to be safe, we should always put things in a box. All right, so our aim now is to find out whether and how the vacuum state at the time eta can be one of the infinitely many states that we could, in principle, write down that come with choices of mode function. Right? So on one hand, we are ready to write down lots of candidates for the vacuum state. Namely, for any choice of mode function, so any solution of the Klein-Gordon equation and the Wronskian condition, any such solution, let's call it V or V tilde or V double tilde, comes with corresponding A operators or A tilde or A double tilde, which then annihilate vectors in the Hilbert space that we may call 0 or 0 tilde or 0 double tilde, infinitely many choices of those, of those, of those. How do we identify which is, at the given time, the actual vacuum state of the theory? Is it this one or that one? By what criterion should we go? That's what I just said here. So we want to identify which V we should choose such that that vector here is the vacuum state. Now, I made earlier the point that to pick a vacuum state is in one-to-one correspondence to picking a mode function, right? Because through the mode function, you get the A dagger operators. Once you have the A operator, you know which vector is annihilated by it. So choosing a mode function is in one-to-one correspondence to choosing or identifying the vacuum state. Now, choosing a mode function, in turn, is also mathematically equivalent to something. It is equivalent to choosing, at one particular time, an amplitude and a derivative. Right? So we said identifying a vacuum state is in one-to-one correspondence to identifying a mode function. But the mode function is the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And the solution to the Klein-Gordon equation can be specified by specifying initial conditions. Right? So we say that at a time eta, or eta 1, we choose this amplitude and that time derivative. Because the Klein-Gordon equation is second order, that will fix a mode function. And the mode function, in turn, fixes the vacuum. Right? So again, vacuum, choosing a vacuum state or pointing out a particular vector in the Hilbert space that might be the vacuum state is the same as pointing out a particular mode function. But to pick a particular mode function is to pick at some time the initial conditions for the mode function. What amplitude, what derivative should the mode function have at that time? Now, why would I say that? Why pointing out that choosing a mode function is the same as choosing its amplitude and derivative at a particular time? Well, it's because the vacuum itself, at best, will be the vacuum at one point in time. Right? So the vacuum itself is associated to a particular point in time. At every point in time, we have to rethink which state in the Hilbert space might be the vacuum state. And so there is a point in time dependence there. So the full picture then is, if we want to know which state in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum at time eta, then that's in one-to-one correspondence to asking which mode function should we pick, which is in one-to-one correspondence to what amplitude, what derivative should the mode function have at that time. Okay, so to specify the vacuum state at time eta, which is to specify a particular vector zero, is equivalent to specifying a mode function vk, a solution to the Klein-Gödel equation and Wronskian condition. But that is equivalent to choosing at the time eta or any other time, but in particular at the time eta, what the amplitude and the first derivative of our mode function is supposed to be. Because if we know what the amplitude is at eta and the derivative at eta, then because the Klein-Gödel equation is second order, that will fix what the mode function is everywhere. So we can choose our vacuum state. We can pick a candidate for the vacuum state by picking these two numbers, Rk and Sk. I mean, the index k is just carried along all the time because for each mode we do this separately. So we choose an amplitude R and a time derivative S at the time eta that we want to specify the vacuum or identify which state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state. So all of these things are the same thing. Here's our first attempt at identifying which state in the Hilbert space might be the vacuum state, which is, we now see, completely, first attempt at identifying which state in the Hilbert space might be the vacuum state at time eta. And that's equivalent to guessing what the right R and S are. So the first attempt is this. Let's try to define the vacuum state at time eta as that Hilbert space vector, which at the time eta minimizes the Hamiltonian. Right? So this is the naive idea that when there are no particles, then the energy should be the lowest. One would think that it's sort of a given. And that would make it really easy if it was as easy as that. So let's just barrel ahead and try that out and see what happens. So to this end, we will choose the amplitude of the mode function at time eta to be a value rk and its time derivative to be a value sk, such that these initial conditions give us a mode function v such that the associated vector zero that's annihilated by the associated A operator happens to be the lowest energy state. And which state of the quantum field theory is the lowest energy state is well defined. We can calculate it always. So let's do that. Let's calculate the lowest energy state of our quantum field theory at some fixed time eta or eta 1. So this state is what we want to find out. Right? We want to find out which mode function corresponds to. So we leave that open for now, which state that exactly is going to be. We calculate the energy expectation value at the time eta 1. And if you remember, the Hamiltonian takes this explicit form, where everything looks just like Minkowski space, except for this a squared factor here in front of the mass, and except for this term, which has all the information about the expansion of the universe. So let us calculate the energy of our quantum field, or energy density.
Could you remind me if minimizing h chi was the same as minimizing h?
Great, I was hoping that somebody would ask that. They are not exactly the same Hamiltonians, and you can do the same study with the H-phi. And there would be a little bit of a difference, but it would not make a difference, a qualitative difference. But it makes it much easier to calculate it for the H-chi because it's a much easier Hamiltonian.
The states will be the same, so you say.
Yes. Yes. But it's a non-trivial exercise to show that. But it's good that you observed that. Okay. So we want to minimize the energy. And how do we do that? Well, we do the Fourier transform in order to turn these spatial derivatives into moment multiplication with the momenta, as usual. And then we plug in our ansatz. So we write the chi field in terms of these mode functions. And remember here, we don't know yet which state that is. We want to find out which one minimizes the energy, right? Now that we plug this stuff into here, we find that these are the unknown guys. We have to optimize over all possible choices of V. So the result is that the energy expectation value at time eta 1 is, after some little calculation here that is, however, completely straightforward, all you have to do is evaluate, now you plug this into there, and then you have the A daggers and the A acting, and they act in the usual way on the zero vectors, etc. Just plug that in, and then you obtain, after a little calculation, that the energy expectation value is given by this expression here, where omega k of eta, I should remind you, omega k is this, right? All of this is omega k. I mean, the Fourier transform of that, right? The Fourier transform of that gives you the omega. Sorry, you have this term, which gives you a k squared, plus that term, right? That's omega k squared. And the square root of k squared plus this is omega k. It's this frequency of the harmonic oscillator, which, if you remember, can even go imaginary. Because if that thing dominates, then omega squared is negative, and therefore omega is imaginary, and therefore we have no longer oscillations, we have exponential increase and decrease. But more on that later. So what we have is that the energy expectation value is this expression here in terms of the mode functions values at time eta 1. And what you see here is that the derivative goes into that and the amplitude goes into that. And these are the two numbers, the derivative and the amplitude, which, in terms of which we can choose the vacuum state, right? Because if we choose the amplitude and the derivative at a particular point in time, then that fixes the solution, because the Klein-Gordon equation is second order. Oh, here I wrote out again what omega k squared is. It's k squared plus m squared, just the terms that we collected up there. We are assuming here an assumption that we will later have to revise, but for now, we will assume that in this expression for omega k squared, this term is not dominant, so that the whole thing is positive, and therefore omega k squared is positive. Because otherwise, you know, the harmonic oscillator would be inverted and we wouldn't find the minimum. So let's assume that it's not inverted, and therefore we can find the minimum. So remember, the amplitude we called r, and the derivative, the time derivative of the mode function, we called s. We need to find values for r and s such that the energy expectation value is minimal. So what we have is simply a harmonic oscillator that's time dependent, because the omega k is time dependent. And at every time It's a different harmonic oscillator, but we want to know at every time what's the minimum energy. So, as we said, the energy at time eta 1 is this expression here. And using our definition for the amplitude at the time eta 1 and the derivative at time eta 1, we can write the energy expectation value at time eta 1 in terms of those parameters R and S, which determine the choice of vacuum. We want to minimize that expression here. Now, you may wonder, well, isn't that easy? I just choose R and S as small as possible. This is the modulus of S squared, and that's the modulus of R squared. Don't we minimize the energy if we choose S equals 0 and R equals 0? That would do it. Yeah, but you see, we can't choose phi and phi prime independently. We can't choose arbitrary initial conditions. We can't choose the amplitude of the mode function and the derivative of the mode function at time eta 1 completely arbitrarily. We could if the only condition that the mode function had to obey was the Klein-Gordon equation. Because then any amplitude, any derivative would be okay. But a mode function has to obey not just the Klein-Gordon equation, but also the Wronskian condition. And the Wronskian condition is a non-linear condition. And the Wronskian condition, if you remember, is this one, right? And that's a condition in particular on the derivatives and the amplitudes. So what this boils down to is that we need to minimize the Hamiltonian by choosing R and S suitably, such that this is minimized subject to a constraint that this holds true. I mean, these are just values of S and R, and here it is. You know, this V prime is an S, and the V star is an R star, etc. So the problem is straightforward. Minimize this, minimize that, subject to this constraint. Now we can solve that problem with the Lagrange multiplier. So this is the energy of the quantum field at time eta 1, expressed in terms of the time derivative and the amplitude of the mode field. And then we have a Lagrange multiplier times the constraint. So then we have to solve ds by the first, I mean, we have to, the derivative with respect to the s has to vanish, the derivative with respect to r has to vanish, and the derivative with respect to lambda has to vanish, which is to impose the constraint. And then I won't go into the details of that, but it's not difficult to solve these two equations along with the constraint of the Wronskian condition. The answer is that the solution and therefore the minimum energy is achieved if the amplitude is chosen to be this value and the time derivative is chosen to be that value, where the theta value is arbitrary. See, in those conditions, it doesn't really matter what the phase is of S and R, as long as it is the same phase. So what have we achieved now? We have found out how to choose the vacuum state if the vacuum state can be identified with the minimum energy state. So for now, we go by that. Let's just say, assume the vacuum state, the no particle state, is the state of lowest energy. Then we know how to identify which Hilbert space vector that is. How do we do that? Well, remember this chain. We have that choosing the vacuum is to choose the mode function, which is to choose its amplitude and derivative at a particular point in time. Right? And so choosing the mode functions amplitude and derivative at a particular point in time gives us the mode function, which gives us the vacuum state at that time. And that's what we have here. We have the amplitude and the derivative of the mode function. So what this means is, in practice, the following. Let's say that at some point in time in the evolution of the universe, we want to know which state is the vacuum state, under the assumption it's the lowest energy state. So we want to know which state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state. Then we have to do the following calculation. Evaluate omega k. Remember, that's dependent on time, right? So evaluate omega k at the point in time that you want to know which state is the vacuum state. So evaluate that, get a number, that's the number. This thing doesn't matter, we choose theta to be 0, so this is just 1. So we take the amplitude of the mode function to be 1 over square root of omega k at the point in time that we want to identify the vacuum state. And we choose the derivative of the mode function at that point in time to be square root of omega k. Again, evaluated at the time where we want to identify the vacuum state. Now, having identified the amplitude and derivative of a mode function at a particular point in time, using the Klein-Gordon equation, this gives us the mode function at all times. And having the mode functions at all times, we can write down the quantum field in terms of the mode function and the A and A Dirac operator. And then the A operator annihilates a particular vector in the Hilbert space, which, as we just established, is the state of lowest energy. Okay, it's all a little complicated and engineering-like, but that's as good as it gets. So this means that at time eta 1, if we want to identify the vacuum state, this is how we do it. Calculate omega k at the time eta 1. That's going to be the amplitude of our mode function. That's going to be the derivative of our mode function. And then the rest is automatic, because these two values give us the mode function everywhere. And then here it is, the mode function at all times. Well, we can write it at all times, because this function now is defined for all times, and similarly the V star. And so we get the quantum field at all times. And then the vector that's annihilated by A is the minimum energy state at that time eta 1. Remember, we minimized the energy of the quantum field at time eta 1. We did not minimize it at any other time. So by having identified this as a possible vacuum state, at best we have identified the vacuum state at time eta 1. Generally speaking, at another time, another state would be the vacuum state. And we would know how to calculate it, right? At time eta 2, we can do the same exercise. Find out which state minimizes the energy of the quantum field. And this would be the answer again. Now you have to evaluate omega k at the second time, eta 2. And you get some amplitude, you get some derivative, and then you can calculate the mode function at all times. And it's not going to be, in general, the same mode function as the one that we calculated previously. So there's going to be a Bogoliubov transformation between the two. And therefore, there's going to be particle creation between the two.
So in the above equations, we have omega k at a time of as a function of eta, but we also have the mode function v as a time of theta. So we have the derivative. So if you could scroll to the.
Yep.
I mean, matching it at all times, we should check whether that gives us the correct time derivative.
Well, remember, in principle, in general, you're not going to get the same mode function if you do that at different times. So if the universe is expanding in some wild ways, and the omega k has some non-trivial time dependence, then you can define a mode function in the following way. You, at one time, eta 1, you choose this to be the amplitude, and you choose that to be the time derivative.
What I mean is that...
Well, just a sec. And then at a second time, you do the same thing. And in both cases, you have initial conditions. Now, once at eta 1, another initial condition at eta 2. And you can calculate using the Klein-Gordon equation what the mode functions are at all times. And they are generally not going to be the same mode function. So it's not something that we need. Oh, yes. Yes.
So the lowest energy state doesn't stay as the lowest, doesn't evolve as the lowest energy state.
I'm not sure what you mean by evolving, because remember, this is the Heisenberg picture. The state itself is not evolving. Yeah. Okay, so let's look at the special case of Minkowski space. Minkowski space is a special case where A of eta is 1 for all eta, because the scale factor is just always 1. There's no expansion, no shrinkage. And then the omega k squared is just k vector squared plus m squared, because the a squared term is just 1, and the other term that had a derivative of a second derivative of a in it is just vanishing. The conformal time is the proper time in the case of of Minkowski space. And so in this case, the state 0 is the state of lowest energy at time eta 1 if we chose the mode functions to obey these conditions here. As before, you know, 1 over omega k, 1 over square root of omega k, and square root of omega k, where omega k is constant in time because it's just this. And in this case, it's clear that if we impose that condition at one time eta 1 or at another time eta 2, then we will get the same solution except for a phase factor. Because the solution, I mean, it's always just going to be a plane wave. We've solved that before. And the only difference between the one or the other plane wave is going to be a phase factor that actually drops out in practical calculations, because we always have a V and a V star. Combining in order to get some expectation value. So what we find is that the mode functions are these. With this, if we impose these initial conditions at time eta 1, then the mode function is given by that, as we had before. And I leave it up to you as a little exercise to check that this is the one. I mean, you just have to look it up, that this is the solution that we found for the quantum field theory early on in the course. Where, if you remember, I didn't really, at the very beginning, I didn't really motivate why that would be the right choice. I just said that this is a solution. But there are more. And now we see that it's a particular solution. It is the one where the vacuum state is the state of lowest energy. Now, let us come back to our ansatz. Let us reconsider the assumption that went into this. So at an arbitrary time eta 1, the no particle state is by assumption the state with the lowest energy. So the vacuum at eta 1 is that state 0 that we just calculated. Then this implies a prediction. It implies that as the universe expands, and the energy changes, we should expect that there is a there is particle production in general. Now, This is a straightforward calculation. You can calculate with an infrared cutoff how many particles you would expect to be created in a given volume in a given amount of time. We do know what the scale factor is of the universe. We do know how much expansion we have. I mean, what the expansion rate is, what the Hubble parameter is. And that's all we need for that particular calculation. And that's been calculated. And it turns out that there is a big mismatch. The prediction would be that with the current expansion rate of the universe, the current production rate of particles would be on the order of about 10 particles per cubic kilometers per year and per species. And that is way too much. So if we assumed that the vacuum state was the lowest energy state, then we have to somehow, we would have to reconcile that with the fact that there are not that many particles. See, what we have is that we currently have about a billion particles per cubic kilometers. That's just a rough order of magnitude estimate of it. And here we see that per year we would have 10 particles created. So that over the age of the universe, and earlier on the expansion was much more dramatic than it is now, we would have created at least as many, and actually because of the much more dramatic changes early on, we would have created many more particles than we see. The particle production coming from expansion, according to this criterion, exceeds the number of particles that we actually can account for. So it seems that if we identify the vacuum state, no particle state, with the state of lowest energy at a point in time, then that implies so much particle production that it contradicts what we see experimentally. In a way, we are lucky because it could have been much more subtle. It could have been that it's sort of consistent with what we see, and then we might go with that definition without rethinking what it should be. So for that reason, the idea has been abandoned to identify the vacuum state as the lowest energy state.
Can you make the Hoyle steady state hypothesis viable for some parameters by doing this?
Yes, so I don't know if everybody knows that, but Fred Hoyle was an astronomer who, by the way, is also credited with coming up with the name Big Bang.
He was mocking it.
Yes, he was mocking the idea, and he said, "No, a Big Bang, really?" But the name stuck, and now everybody calls it a Big Bang. So he didn't like the idea of a Big Bang, and he, similar to Einstein originally, believed that the universe might be at a steady state. And initially, Einstein's idea was that it might not be expanding, it might just be sitting there at the universe, just steady, probably forever. But then somebody showed, Lemaître showed, that that's not stable. The universe can't be just sitting there. It has to be expanding or shrinking. Everything else would not be stable. And in any case, the expansion was well established. You know, Hubble found the Hubble parameter quite early. It was in the 40s or something. But then there were still people like Fred Hoyle who said, yeah, the universe might be expanding, but that doesn't mean that there must have been a Big Bang. Maybe what's happening is that as the universe is expanding, everything is diluting. But for some reason, and he didn't know yet why, for some reason, matter might be created continuously, so as to make up for the dilution effect. So the universe could be, in principle, expanding, diluting matter, but the matter density could actually be finite and constant, at least on average, because matter is continually being created. And here we have a mechanism that would continually create matter. Too much, as it turns out, but it would continually create matter. Now, so then the question arises, if that could be tweaked, and then in principle, couldn't that make, I mean, just so that the orders of magnitude come out more nicely, couldn't that revive the Hoyle steady-state universe idea?
I wasn't so much suggesting that, because there's other evidence.
Yes, other evidence. Exactly. That's what I was just going to, that there is other evidence, right. Because we can now see...
If you could build a steady-state universe, you know, in imagination,
yes.
That would work.
I think you could. It still wouldn't be stable, but yes, you could do that. And the other evidence is, of course, that nowadays we can look so far back at the universe that we see the actual evolution. We see that earlier stars had less metallicity in it, which means that they were more purely just hydrogen and helium, whereas if a star forms now, it incorporates not just hydrogen and helium, it also incorporates a lot of the debris from previous supernovas. And so we see that, you know, stars ages ago were quite a different bunch than the ones today. And in any case, we see the CMB and lots of other things. So it's no question that there was an evolution. It's not steady state. Yeah?
I was just curious about what the vacuum would be like if the universe was contracting. Because, like, you have creation if it's expanding, but what happens when it's contracting?
I think you would still have creation of particles. And strictly speaking, you can also have that particles disappear. If you simply run the time evolution backwards, you would have the particles disappear. That's right. But if you start with a vacuum state and then run it backwards, you would still have particle creation. And simply because what used to be the vacuum state is no longer the vacuum state, so it has to be excited state. Well, there is nothing else. I mean, the lowest energy state, if the lowest particle state is the vacuum state, then it's like whenever you do something to the vacuum, you have to invest energy to that. If it's the ground state. Okay, so now let us reconsider this then. We probably shouldn't identify the vacuum state, the no particle state, with the lowest energy state. And the idea here is that actually in the universe, these mode oscillators are evolving slowly. The universe is not expanding dramatically. In particular now, or over the past few billion years, the universe has not undergone dramatic expansions. And for harmonic oscillators, we would expect that if we change their parameters slowly, we don't excite them much. And so the overall idea then is, let me just skip all the text because it's just basically for you to read later if you want to review these things. Here, I just speak it in words. The overall idea is, and this is where it gets engineering, subtle, technical, and not elegant. The overall idea then is, to identify the vacuum state, the no particle state, as that state. Or let me back up. The idea is to come up with a method for identifying the vacuum state, which boils down to a method for fixing those numbers R and S, right? The amplitude and the time derivative of a mode function at a particular point in time, because that fixes the mode function at all time, that fixes the A, and it annihilates a vector that we then call the vacuum state, right? So the overall idea now that we throw overboard the minimum energy hypothesis, the overall idea now is we want to come up with a vacuum identification criterion which is fine-tuned in such a way, so our method for identifying the R and S values is fine-tuned in such a way that if we apply this criterion, then the predicted particle creation is minimal. See? So among all the possible criteria that we could choose to identify which vacuum, which state in the Hilbert space is the vacuum state, we choose that criterion according to which the prediction for the creation of particles is minimal. That's the adiabatic vacuum. That's the definition of the adiabatic vacuum. Once we find it, once we find out. So what we now need to do is find out what condition on R and S we have to put. How do we have to choose the R and S such that the induced state zero is a vacuum state which has the property that if we apply that criterion at multiple times and we check how much particle creation has been in between, it's the minimum amount possible. So it all boils down to identifying a mode function vk, right? Because once we've done that, we have our A operator, and then whatever it annihilates is what we call the vacuum state. Right. Now, let's first do this for a universe which starts out at a Minkowski phase. So let's assume the universe starts out at a Minkowski phase. Then we know what the vacuum state is. So let's say we know Vk at very early times when the universe was still Minkowski space. Then it's this. Then, of course, the Klein-Gordon equation gives us a mode function at all times. When the universe starts deviating from Minkowski space, when it starts expanding, the Klein-Gordon equation becomes non-trivial. The solution no longer looks like this, but it's determined by the fact that it looked like this early on. Because the Klein-Gordon equation can just be used to work out what the Klein-Gordon equation solution is at all times. If we know it, if we know the solution at early times, we can work it out at all times. Now, here's the proposition. If the universe doesn't expand dramatically, if it is something like today, where it's just, well, it's expanding, but it's nothing particularly dramatic. We don't see much particle creation. In fact, we have no evidence whatsoever of particle creation through expansion in our current universe. So if there's nothing dramatic going on, if the universe is expanding in a way that is slow enough that we would describe it as what is called adiabatic, I'll give you the conditions for that in a moment, then actually this is a very good approximation for what the mode function is at all times. So if the mode function starts out like this, and then the Klein-Gordon equation becomes non-trivial because the universe is expanding, but it's expanding very slowly, then the mode function looks like that. This is not the exact solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, but it's a very good approximation to the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation at all times. It's a so-called adiabatic solution. So when is this approximation a good approximation? We say that a mode k evolves adiabatically slow, because we have to check for adiabaticity for every mode separately. Remember that for some modes, the frequency might even be imaginary, while for some other modes, it might be real, right? Because the discriminant, omega k, might be positive, omega k squared might be positive or negative, depending on k. It all depends on the k value. So we say that a mode k evolves adiabatically slowly if the time derivative of omega divided by omega squared is smaller than 1, and if the second time derivative, which is divided by omega to the third power, is much smaller than 1. Now, why do we divide by these? Well, we have to, because otherwise it makes no sense. You see, if we just said that omega prime is small, it makes no sense whatsoever. Intuitively, it makes sense, right? It means that omega doesn't change very quickly. The frequency doesn't change very quickly, so our parameter in the Hamiltonian doesn't change very quickly. It's a harmonic oscillator that is dependent on a parameter, but very slowly. But if we don't divide by this, this thing has units. And we could always choose units. It's a frequency divided by time, right? It's a frequency is 1 over time, the unit, and then you divide by time, so it's 1 over time squared. So we could always choose units such that this is a tremendously large number. So in order to speak of such a thing as being small or large, we have to divide by something which has the same units, and that would be omega squared. So if this number, this dimensionless number, is much smaller than 1, and that dimensionless number is much smaller than 1, then we speak of adiabaticity. We say that the evolution of the universe is slow enough. It basically means that the oscillations in the Klein-Gordon equation are fast compared to the change in the Klein-Gordon equation. There are many oscillations in the Klein-Gordon equation, in the solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, before any significant change in the evolution of omega itself. The parameters in the equation of motion change slowly compared to the actual motion of the degree of freedom. Okay, and I leave it to you to prove that if these conditions are met, then this is a very good approximation to the Klein-Gordon equation, no matter what the time dependence of omega k of eta is. You see, it could be arbitrary time dependence, as long as it's not too dramatic. As long as it's adiabatic, it could be anything, and this is the solution. You see, if it wasn't approximate, we would never be able to write down the exact solution here.
Is it always going to be possible for that adiabatic condition for a massless particle to hold for all k?
No, generally it will not.
Okay.
Yeah. Point. So is the initial Minkowski period really necessary in this? So let us try to identify the vk where this vector is the adiabatically defined vacuum without referring to what the vk would look like in an earlier Minkowski period of the universe. So from here, let me just back up. Remember what the intention now is. We said that we want a criterion for identifying the vacuum state, which is such that if we use this criterion, we end up predicting the least possible particle creation. Now, we just did this for Minkowski space, if the universe starts with a Minkowski space. Because what we said is that if the universe evolves very slowly, then this is going to be the mode function everywhere, at all points in time. So what we want is a criterion for identifying the vacuum state, which at whatever time we apply it will give us this mode function. The same mode function as early on in Minkowski space and later on. If we did that, we would predict no particle creation whatsoever. It's a bit of a fudge because it's only approximate, right? So generally, what we want is a criterion for picking mode functions, for picking the vacuum state, therefore, which is such that if the universe expands adiabatically, which is an approximation, if it were to expand adiabatically exactly according to the adiabatic solution here S, then we would predict no particle creation. And any particle creation that does happen is because of non-adiabaticity, is because of a difference between the actual evolution of the mode function and the adiabatic solution which is obtained in this way. So now let us free ourselves from looking at Minkowski space early on. and just work generally. Okay. So let us look at the mode function that we calculated. Sorry, I have to go back again to show it to you. Here it is. So this is the mode function that we obtain if the universe is expanding adiabatically, and it is at early times, it is simply the Minkowski space mode function. But at late times, it's somewhat different. So what we need is a criterion for identifying the vacuum state, which is mathematically in one-to-one correspondence to having a criterion for identifying a mode function. Because remember, choosing a mode function is to choose a vacuum state, right? Because with a mode function comes an A operator. And then the state that it annihilates is our vacuum state. So we need, we are after a criterion for identifying what at a particular time is the vacuum state, which vector in a Hilbert space is the vacuum state. And then we said that's the same as picking a mode function, which is the same as picking initial conditions at that time for the mode function. Now, in the case of Minkowski space, and then following after that, just adiabatic evolution, we know that this would be the mode function we want. And we want it at every point in time. We want our criterion to be such that it always points to this solution. Because then we always have the same mode function, therefore we always have the same vector zero. We always identify the same vector as being the vacuum state, and therefore we don't have particle creation. And any particle creation that we do get would be because we have just an approximation here, and the real thing evolves a little bit more complicatedly. So let us look at what the amplitude of this mode function is at a particular point in time, and what is its derivative at a particular point in time. Because that's what we need to enforce in order to choose a vacuum. We need to choose an amplitude, we need to choose a derivative. Let's read it off from that. Does this solution, the desired adiabatic solution, does it have a particular pattern to its amplitude and derivative at a particular point in time? Well, we can calculate that. Here it is. It turns out that this solution that I just showed you has the following property. At an arbitrary time eta, the amplitude is given by this, 1 over square root of omega k, just like for the case of minimum energy. Right? When we try to identify the vacuum state as the minimum energy state, that's also how we identified the amplitude at a particular time eta. But the derivative is different. We see that for this adiabatic solution, what we have is that the derivative at time eta is given by this expression here. Now, that term alone was basically what we had. I mean, that term divided by this one, because we just had the square root of omega k, if you remember. That term alone was the term that gave us the minimum energy. That gave us that we, if in other words, if you drop this, this and that condition are exactly the condition that pinpoint the minimum energy state as the vacuum state. And now we see that if we upgrade that and instead take that into account, then these two conditions pinpoint the adiabatic mode function, which is the mode function that you get at every point in time. So that as long as the universe is expanding adiabatically, you get the same mode function at every time. Your vacuum identification criterion points to the same mode function at every time, and therefore the same vacuum state, and therefore no particle creation whatsoever, except for the fact that it's an approximation, which will give us particle creation. But to lowest order, there is none. And that will dramatically cut down on the prediction of how many particles will be created. Because the adiabatic approximation is really an excellent approximation, for example, for the past few billion years in the universe. So what we arrive at is this. We had a criterion for identifying the vacuum, which failed. It was to say the vacuum state is the state of lowest energy. And it consisted of the following. It said that in order to identify the vacuum state at the particular point eta, at a particular point in time eta, all you have to do is calculate omega k at that time eta, get an amplitude. Calculate omega k at the same time, get the derivative of the amplitude. That gives you a mode function. And then once you have a mode function, you get a vacuum state as the state that's annihilated by the corresponding A operator. And now we say that, no, instead you do something very similar, except you have to take into account this term as well. And then you obviously get a slightly different mode function. It's no longer the same criterion. But this criterion, this method of picking the vacuum state, is a method that guarantees that we get the least prediction for particle creation as long as we get the least prediction for particle creation, and as long as the approximation of adiabaticity is very good, we are basically predicting no particle creation.
I have a question.
Yep.
But if the evolution is far from adiabatic, then I don't see how this shows that the vacuum state is a state that creates, for which a minimum number of particles is created.
That's right. So the statement that this vacuum identification criterion leads to the least amount of particle production is a statement that's local in time. So if we look at the stretch in time during which we have adiabaticity or approximate adiabaticity, then this criterion gives us the least prediction for particle creation. But it's still applicable even in the highly non-adiabatic regime, namely if we start out in an adiabatic regime and we end up in an adiabatic regime. So for example, we start out in an adiabatic regime, then we can use this criterion to identify what should be the vacuum state there. Because locally, in time, this is the state that predicts the least particle production. That's what we would expect because of adiabaticity. So that fixes what state the system is in, because it's the Heisenberg picture, and then that's the state that it's going to be. And then there could be dramatic time evolution, even time evolution in which the harmonic oscillator goes like this for a while. So absolutely non-adiabatic, even beyond the meaning of what adiabatic or non-adiabatic means, because it's no longer a harmonic oscillator. But then that period ends, and eventually things settle down, and we have, again, ordinary expansion, pretty much adiabatic. And this is pretty much what's happening in the universe now. We had a period of inflation that was very dramatic, with the potential going like this, but then things settled down, and now our oscillators are like that again. And now, again, we can identify which state is the vacuum state, the adiabatic vacuum state. And we have to choose the adiabatic vacuum, otherwise we would predict too much particle creation over the past 10 billion years. And then we can calculate how much particle creation there was from before inflation to today, because the state of the system is still the state that we originally identified. It came with some mode function, right? It came with some mode function identified through the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion. And then today, too, we can calculate which is the vacuum state today, the adiabatic vacuum. It comes also with a mode function. And those two mode functions are not the same, because there was this dramatic period of inflation in between. So those two mode functions are not the same, which means there are Bogoliubov coefficients between the two. And there's going to be beta coefficients between the two, which we will calculate. And they give us then the prediction for, you know, how much inhomogeneities there are in the CMB and all of that. Yep.
So if you have an accelerating expansion, that will affect your, like, one of your adiabaticity conditions, right? Not the second derivative, but the first derivative. Would that lead to particle?
Yes. Well, actually, it will be beyond good and evil, because because once it goes like this, none of the adiabaticity makes sense. These adiabaticity conditions are assuming that we are almost adiabatic anyway. And yeah.
It's pretty small right now.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, so let me quickly summarize. So what we have is that consider an arbitrary time eta 1, which could be today, or it could be before inflation starts, or some time anyway where the evolution is adiabatically slow. So we shouldn't pick a time where stuff is happening in a big way. Then the adiabatic criterion makes no sense. For example, if the harmonic oscillators go like this, we shouldn't apply that criterion, because there is no sense in which there are particles to start with. You can't build a Fock space in that case, because there's no vacuum state at all. But let's consider a time during which the universe evolves more or less adiabatically. Let's call that time eta 1. Then, and of course, we should say that the notion of adiabaticity also depends on the mode. Because adiabaticity means that the degree of freedom in question, the harmonic oscillator in question, oscillates much faster than the speed with which the parameters of the harmonic oscillator vary. Now, of course, that depends on k. So all of this discussion is k-dependent. Some modes will be in the adiabatic regime when others are not. Okay, so let's assume that at the time eta 1, we are looking at a mode which is in the adiabatic regime. Then we identify that Hilbert space vector as the vacuum state, which is annihilated by the A operator that comes with that mode function, which at time eta 1 has these initial conditions, this one and that one, amplitude and time derivative, where this is the adiabatic solution here. And the theta doesn't matter. Okay? And if the evolution is adiabatic throughout, then this criterion ends up picking the same mode function at all time, which means no particle creation. However, if between eta 1 when we do this and eta 2 when we do this again, there is some period such as inflation, then at eta 1 we get some mode function out of this, because these are initial conditions for a mode function. And at time eta 2, we get another mode function out of that. They live in the same solution space, but they're linear combinations of each other. And these Bogoliubov coefficients, alpha and beta, are what give us then particle creation. In particular, we know that the modulus squared of beta k gives us the expected creation of particles.
Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference if we consider a very long time in which the expansion is adiabatic, like for example just after the inflation until today? It's a bit out, it might be a bit out of adiabaticity, but does it stay adiabatic for a very long time?
It's a matter of approximation. You know, that's why it is a little, the whole thing is a little dirty there, because it's not an elegant thing. I mean, to reply concretely to what you said, yes, there is going to be some particle creation between just after inflation ends and today because of the expansion. But just generally, I'm not happy with this criterion. It sort of works, but well, it's not something that could be generalized to arbitrary space-times. And the reason is that this condition has its origin in us knowing that we started out with Minkowski, that remember how we derived it? We said, what if a universe starts out with Minkowski space? And then we adiabatically make it change a little bit. And then that fixes the adiabatic solution for us. And then we said, from the adiabatic solution, we can read off what the desired amplitudes and derivatives are. And then we make that a universal criterion. But what if in the universe there never was and never will be any Minkowski phase? Then what do we use for that? So it's sort of, yeah, it's an engineering fix. But then on the other hand, it might be that there isn't anything better, that there isn't really a fundamental definition of what the vacuum state is, because there may not fundamentally exist a vacuum state, which is a dramatic thing, because it means that fundamentally we don't even know how to define particles. Because if we can't define the no particle state, we can't define the one particle state either. or the n-particle state. It's just an approximation. Only as well as we know what the vacuum state is, do we know what the one-particle state is. Yeah, so in the literature, this method for identifying which vector in a Hilbert space describes the vacuum. It's called the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion. And the vacuum picked in this way is called the adiabatic vacuum, as opposed to, for example, the lowest energy vacuum. This is the last slide. So just to remind you, these were the criteria for the lowest energy vacuum state. And the only difference is an extra. So this just has the square root of omega k. And this one has square root of omega k, because omega k here and square root of omega k in the denominator. So it's just the square root of omega k. It would be exactly the same. This thing changes it a little bit. And the amazing thing that another amazing thing that comes from this is that we see that if the no particle state is not the lowest energy state, right? So if the vacuum state is not the lowest energy state, then the lowest energy state is not the vacuum state. So the lowest energy state is a state in which there are particles, right? So the lowest energy state, you can calculate which one it is. We did it, right? So you can calculate which is the state of lowest energy. It's a state with particles. The difference is tiny between the two, but there is a difference. And so by actually adding a certain mix of particles, you are lowering the energy. A super weird thing. Anyway, when I taught this course before, I was speculating that the difference between the adiabatic vacuum and the minimum energy vacuum state might be related to the presence of a cosmological constant. See? What we have is that the actual vacuum is not the minimum energy vacuum. Right? According to what we just discussed today, the actual vacuum, the adiabatic vacuum, is not the minimum energy vacuum. So then we can ask, well, how much elevated is it? What is the extra energy density that we have in the adiabatic vacuum compared to the minimum energy density vacuum? And, well, sure enough, a student looked into this. I mean, one of you guys who was in the audience, I mean, like years ago, and he calculated it and just did some rough estimate, and it comes out to be of the order of the vacuum energy that's been observed. It is, however, a rather complicated calculation, and at the end we gave up because somebody seemed to have had the same rough idea, but then worked it out in a way that is not quite correct. And when we tried to do it better, we found it super hard to do, because the renormalization that is required in this is just very hard to do. Renormalization of a quantum field theory in curved spacetime is a very difficult thing to do. But should be interesting to pursue. Who knows? Maybe this has this difference, this subtle difference between the lowest energy state and the adiabatic vacuum state might account for something. Maybe it has to do with the vacuum energy.
Just, but that still leaves open the question of why that should be the thing that gravitates.
Why it should be the thing that gravitates?
Right. Why the difference between the adiabatic vacuum and the minimum energy vacuum should be the thing that gravitates.
Well, it should be the only thing that gravitates, right? Because, I mean, in general, energy should gravitate. But the question is, why does the minimum energy not gravitate? Why does the vacuum energy itself not gravitate? You see, the one half h bar omega of each mode should gravitate, but it doesn't. We'll get back to that issue later on. Okay?